This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Sit down, Joe. Why do you think I'm here?
Well, we're having a scene, as you can see, and it's hard to tell whether it's clowning or for real between the two fighters. This kind of thing is... been going on all along in terms of promotion of a fight, and this time it seems to be for real, because Joe Frazier is really angry. I think that Ali is probably clowning.
And my wife's behind ain't for every man to look at. You understand, sir? It makes a lot of sense. So how can I protect my woman if I'm walking down the street, she's half naked, and some sadist run up and grab her? Hell, I shouldn't have put out there. If I got merchandise I want to sell, I put them in the window for you to see. So if I want my wife, why don't I want everybody to see my wife? What's private? What's mine? Everybody looking at her. What do you mean, what's wrong with it? How can you have a wife or somebody you love? Anything God made precious, nature hides it. You cannot find diamonds easy. You have to dig and dig and dig. Then you got to work to clean them. You cannot find gold. Everything God made valuable, he made it hard to get. Pearls, rubies, and ain't my all. You have to dig, and half the time you don't strike. Everything God created that was valuable, he made it hard to get to. Ain't my woman more important than some diamonds and some oil and some gold when she's the field which produced my sons and daughters? Why should she walk around all nude in all of these design clothes? Her breasts is out. She's on the beach wearing clothes that show more than her panties when she go to bed.
Do you have a bodyguard? No, you don't.
I got one bodyguard. When he wishes to create a thing, he just orders it to be and it comes into existence. But this order is not conveyed in words which takes a tongue to formulate or with sound carries ears. He hears the secrets of those under quiet thoughts. He stops those whom, who's that? That's God. Oh, he's my bodyguard. He's your bodyguard.
Greetings of peace. How are you guys doing? Welcome to the Dean Show. I got a special guest here with me, Jonathan Ike. He's the critically acclaimed best-selling author. We're going to get into a story. And then from the story, let's see. I mean, the picture might give it away, but Jonathan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Thank you for being with us on the Dean Show.
Thank you.
Don't go to the shot with the picture yet. We're going to start off with a story from your book.
Yeah.
Okay? And then we're going to get into more from there. I'll start it off. It was an elderly man with his grandson, right?
That's right.
And he was looking for a famous individual. He ends up at his finally finding him. And what happens then? Tell us about the story. You take off with it.
This elderly man, he's from Tanzania with his grandson, travels to the United States. They go to Chicago first, knocking on doors, looking for Muhammad Ali.
Muhammad Ali.
They can't find him in Chicago. They hear that he's moved to Los Angeles. They take a plane to Los Angeles. And they go riding around in a taxi looking for a house that looks like Ali's house. They have a picture of Ali's house from the newspaper. And they find the house. They go up, knock on the door, and they're carrying a Big Mac in a bag because, you know, they want to make an offering, a humble gesture of to Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
You know, you don't arrive empty-handed. So this elderly man and his grandson knock on the door, and Ali answers, and the old man says, "We've come all the way from Africa. We were looking for Muhammad Ali. I wanted my son, my grandson, to meet the great Muhammad Ali before he died. I want him to be able to say that he met Muhammad Ali." And Ali, this is the mid-1990s now. He's been out of the spotlight for a while. He's older. He's has trouble walking. He speaks very softly. He murmurs and you know, very softly, hard to understand.
Was this around the '80s? Now,
mid nineties. Before he lights the Olympic torch, He's really in a period of where he's not getting a lot of attention. He's a little bit depressed, to be honest.
Yeah,
but he welcomes this old man and his grandson into the house. He makes them sandwiches. He eats the Big Mac, And
he
ate the Big Mac. He ate the Big Mac. Like, wow. One bite. And his manager, Larry Kolb, was there with him. And Larry is the one who told me this story. And hours go by, and Ali's entertaining them with stories. He's doing magic tricks for them. And then after a while, realizes it's been most of the afternoon. They get in the car. Ali offers to drive them back to the motel that they're staying at by the airport. So they pile into Ali's Rolls Royce, and they drive this older man and his grandson to the hotel, and they say goodbye. They give hugs and handshakes, and when they're leaving, they're driving back to Ali's house. Larry Kolb, the manager, turns to Ali and says, why do you spend the whole day with those people? You know, you could have just signed an autograph and they would have been perfectly happy. And Ali said something that was really remarkable. He said, I believe that there's a tallying angel, that there's an angel who's counting all of your good deeds and all of your bad deeds. And I've done a lot of bad things in my life. I've been not always a good husband, not always a good father. I've made a lot of mistakes, and this is my time to make up for those mistakes and to do more good deeds so that I go to paradise, because he had a very vivid impression of what hell was like and what paradise was like, and he really felt that he had work to do in order to ensure his place in paradise, and that's why he spent all that time with that older man and with his grandson. And
a very touching story. He actually did, he had a vivid image in your book. You talk about, he talks about the hellfire, like the sizzling.
Yeah.
Know, he thought
it was like putting your hand on a frying pan for eternity, for millions of years.
Yeah. And, but just to take a time out like that, and he puts them in his Rolls Royce and he takes them to, he spends, like he said, the day with them. That's something just unheard of. You know, you think about celebrities and people, you know, time is money.
Yeah, right? That's right.
They don't have time for anyone. Just really many, not all, but many people are egotistic, narcissistic. They don't want to, you know, connect with the outside world, but he connected. I mean, you show that he couldn't say no to anybody.
He loved it. He fed off of it. Yeah. You know, a lot of people would say to him, you know, he's a big famous guy, comes to your office for a business meeting or something. They'd say, Muhammad, we have a car waiting for you in the back alley so that you can get out of here quickly. And he'd say, no, pull it around to the front. I want the people to see me. Uh-huh. And he'd spend an hour, even if he would be late for his next appointment, he'd spend an hour on the street just playing around with people. He couldn't get enough.
He loved people. Now let's talk about you now for a minute. What motivated you to write this book, this biography? So many have been written, so many documentaries, and now the timing now, what motivated you to put this together?
You know, I was a kid in the 70s. Yeah. I can remember rooting for Ali against George Foreman and Joe Frazier. And to me, he was the greatest hero because he was so different. He was outspoken. He had political stands. He wasn't just about the sport. He was about something bigger. And as a kid, I didn't fully appreciate that, but I just knew there was something magical about this guy. And the fact that he was black, the fact that he was a Muslim.
You know, the word Muslim means one who submits entirely to the will of God. Mm-hmm. One who submits entirely to the will of God. That's what Muslim means.
Was all, again, as a kid to me, just kind of strange stuff that I didn't fully understand. But when it occurred to me that nobody had yet written a full biography of Ali, there, as you said, there have been documentaries, there have been a lot of books written about different aspects of his life, but nobody had done the full biography. And it's now 50 years since he took his stand against the Vietnam War. It's 53 years since he changed his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali and embraced Islam. I thought it was time, and enough time had gone by, that you could really put some of those events in historical perspective. And there were still enough people around to talk to who were alive back then who knew him, including his wives. Ali was alive at the time I began this work. So it just seemed like the right time to do a big look at his life.
Were you there at his janazah, his funeral prayer?
Yes.
That was in his hometown?
Yeah, it was in Louisville. Yeah. June of last year I was there.
Was your book already you were still writing it in the ending phases? Or?
Yeah, I was getting close to done at that point, but I still had some work to do. So, but I had already spoken to most of the key people in his life and saw them all down there at the janazah service.
Now, who were the key players in his life that were who are still around today, that some of them that you actually got to spend some time with?
Well, three of his four wives are still living.
And three of them. The first one was Belin.
Sanji was his first wife, and she passed away in the 80s. But Belinda, who later changed her name to Khalila,
she was the one. Let me refresh that. Herbert Muhammad.
Introduced.
Right, okay.
Right. So she was raised in the Nation of Islam.
Yes.
And her parents were some of the very first members of the Nation of Islam. So she was, it was almost like an arranged marriage, the Nation
but
of Islam.
But she wasn't practicing, or she didn't, is that the first one?
Sanji didn't practice.
Yes, she was. Then Belinda came.
Belinda came.
She's still around.
She's still around.
So you got to spend some time with her.
Spent a lot of time with her.
Yeah.
As well as his third wife, Veronica, and his current wife, or his most recent wife, at the time of his death, he was still married to Lani.
Yeah.
So I spent time with all of them, and mm-hmm. they're all remarkable women, and they obviously knew him better than anybody.
Yeah. And then you have how about some of these other key players like Herbert Muhammad? I wasn't too fond of him.
No, Herbert passed away.
Okay.
His son.
He was taking his cut was 30-40%.
Yeah, he took a lot of money from Ali, but Ali still loved him. You know, Ali didn't care about money.
That was amazing.
He just let it go. Uh-huh. You know, and he knew Herbert was taking 30-40% of everything, and off the top, before taxes, before expenses. But Ali just didn't care. All his life, he didn't really care about money. He just, you know, he said, if people want to take it from me, they must need it.
Yeah.
It really, some would say naive. Other people would say amazing attitude.
What fight was that where you had Don King? I'm not too fond of him either. May God help us all, you know. Is he still around?
Yeah, Don's still around.
Did you get to hang out?
I got to spend time with him.
So yeah. I don't know, you know, there's hope for everybody, you know, until the end. But he went, there was a situation, I don't know, it was a fight that Ali was supposed to get. You talk about this in your book. He was supposed to get 6-7 million, correct me if I'm ever wrong. And then he only gave him so much, and there was like $1.2 million left, something like that. So he goes and sends the guy with the notary, gives him 50,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Ali just, you know.
Ali signed a contract giving Don King $1 million in exchange for $50,000 in cash.
And $1 million, so he owes him $1 million.
So he's taking the cash, $50,000, and saying, I'll give you a check for $1 million. So he's basically trading $50,000 for $1 million. And,
yeah.
and he knew it was stupid, but he just couldn't say no. And Don King just, you know, laughed all the way to the bank.
So you got to collect a lot of data, a lot of information. How did that feel? I mean, going back, you know, to spend time. I would love to spend time. You know, you some people who knew him the best, who were there with him through, they were there from the beginning, right?
Yeah, even his brother, who, you know, was
his
only
brother.
2 years younger.
Uh-huh.
His brother's still around, and I spent a lot of time with Rahman. And, you know, Rahman could tell you, you know, what they had in the backyard, what kind of toys they had, where the goldfish pond was, all this stuff. You know, he took me into their bedroom where they were raised and told me, you know, where the beds were positioned. And, you know, all of these great details that you can't really get if you wait another, you know, 10 or 20 years to write this book. So it was a real thrill for me to be able to walk in Ali's footsteps a little bit and to see how he lived and to know the people who knew him the best.
Tell us a little about yourself. How long have you been? How long have you had this passion for writing? When did you start? And talk to us a little bit about.
Sure, yeah. I've always liked writing, even from you know, grade school days. And I worked at my, you know, school newspaper, and then worked at my hometown newspaper, and then went to college and studied journalism and worked at newspapers in all over the country, and ended up at the Wall Street Journal. That was my most recent job. And then started writing
books.
I worked at the Wall Street Journal for 6 years. And left there just to begin writing books. And I've been writing books for the last 15 years.
You did something also on Al Capone.
Yeah, I wrote a book about Al Capone.
How long ago was that?
That was 2010, I guess.
Uh-huh.
It was really about the case against Capone, how the government went about trying to get him, and in many cases had to, you know, concoct evidence and do all kinds of sneaky things to put him away.
Ask you about that, it's interesting. He actually died, Al Capone, of an illness, right?
Syphilis. Right.
Yeah?
Yeah, he probably had it most of his adult life and could have been treated for it early on, but wasn't. And as a result, by the time he went to prison, it began to affect his brain, and he began to go mad from the syphilis eating away.
Yeah, and you go over some new statistics regarding Muhammad Ali's condition, and you cite something like 200,000 plus hits that he took.
That's my best estimate. Yeah. What I did was I worked with a company that does boxing statistics, and we actually counted every punch that hit Ali over the course of his career. We watched every round of every fight,
wow.
and we charted the punches, not just how many, but what kind of punch they were. So
hold on. So you actually said...
Not me. They did. These guys from CompuBox.
Yeah, every punch.
Every punch. Every punch he threw and every punch that was thrown at him.
Yeah.
And we were able to see how much damage he was taking, how much damage he was giving over the course of his career. And you could see that as he gets older, which was, you know, to be expected, he begins slowing down and taking a lot more punches. And in the second half of his career, he's taking more punches than he's giving. So what I did was I took those numbers and I extrapolated them over the course of his amateur career. You know, if we know that he took, for example, you know, 13 punches per round on average over the course of his career, if you extrapolate that for his amateur career, for sparring sessions, for exhibitions, my estimate is that he took about 200,000 punches over the course of his career.
And it was said that early in the early 70s is when his family was starting to get concerned about some of the brain damage that was happening. Is that correct?
That's right. They began to notice that he was slurring his speech, that he was mumbling. Even if you go back and you watch him on TV now, go on YouTube and just watch his interviews over the years, you can see it, that over the course of the 70s, his voice gets softer, harder to understand, and the words come more slowly. And this was a guy who was a brilliant, brilliant linguist. I mean, he was a fabulous speaker, and he was funny, and he was quick. But it's sad. You can watch his speech deteriorating, and that's a sign of neurological damage.
Mm-hmm. But he kept on for another
10 years.
10 years.
Yeah, he kept fighting. And even, you know, when he began to realize it, there are all these interviews where he would ask reporters, "Do you think I'm getting punch drunk? Do you think I'm getting brain damaged? Because people say that I don't sound right." So he was aware of it. But the money was so good. He was being pushed by all these people around him to keep fighting because they liked having the money too. They liked the lifestyle. It's hard to give up.
Well, that shows, I mean, when we talk about his genuine, sincere love for people like this Herbert, and what role did Arum is still around today, right?
Yeah, Bob Arum's still around.
Did you spend time with him?
Yeah, I interviewed Bob a couple of times.
Yeah, and some of the other key players, this is just my opinion. When you really care for someone, right, when money's not a top priority, you want what's best for them.
Right.
You follow me? But you're talking about they like that entourage, they like the money, the fame, everything, and they're getting a part of that. And you really care for the man, and you're going to put him really first, and maybe this it wouldn't have went to the extent that it did. What do you think?
Yeah, it's tough to say because obviously responsibility lies with Ali primarily, but if some of the other people in his corner had said, "I won't go, I won't be a part of this anymore, I quit," maybe it would have gotten his attention. I mean, his mother and father were saying quit, but they were still coming to his fights and still cheering for him. And, you know, his family maybe could have done more too. It's hard to say, but all these people are, you know, they're riding that train, they're taking that money, and nobody wants to see it end because they're never going to have easy money like that again.
I was getting the impression that because he continued to fight, he wasn't all there, and he wasn't able to make those decisions as someone who wasn't brain damaged the way he was.
That's right. It's a bit of a catch-22, right?
Yeah.
Is the brain damage making his judgment impaired so that he can't decide whether to quit or not? Mm-hmm. Or is it the other way around? You know, it's really sad. It may be that he wasn't really in good enough shape anymore to make those decisions for himself, and a wife or a father or a mother should have come in and said, you know, no more.
There was his trainer, and was it Angelo Dundee. He's passed away.
Yes,
right?
He is.
But there was one fight where he threw in the towel. He stopped the fight. That was against was it Holmes?
Against Larry Holmes.
Larry Holmes.
Unfortunately, it was, you know, much too late. It was late in his career. He was already 40 years old. Or 39, and it was also just late in that fight. He'd already taken a massive beating. He never should have been in the ring that night at all.
Mm-hmm. We talked about him not being able to say no, right? But there was one man that you mentioned that he said no to, and it was Louis Farrakhan. He came to visit him, and he was trying to revive the nation.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, Farrakhan told me this story that really amazed me because it...
You got to spend time with him also.
I did.
You're here with everybody.
Yeah, I'm very persistent. I get people to talk to me. So, you know, Ali became a Muslim because of the Nation of Islam, because of Elijah Muhammad.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just the religion. It was race. It was a big part of it. He liked what it had to say about being black in America. So when Elijah Muhammad died, Elijah's sons took the Nation of Islam in a different direction, eventually broke it up and took their followers into Orthodox Islam. And Ali went along and became a more traditional Muslim. But Minister Farrakhan decided he wanted to try to rebuild the Nation of Islam and restore the teachings of Elijah Muhammad. So he went to Muhammad Ali and said, "Brother Muhammad, you know, we did not become Muslims because of the Quran. We became Muslims because of the teachings of Elijah Muhammad. I want to restore the teachings. I want to rebuild the Nation of Islam, and you know, will you come with me?" And the story that Farrakhan told me is that they were in Ali's kitchen, and there was a football game on TV, and Ali said, "Farrakhan, do you see that TV? You see that football game? How many people are in that stadium?" And Ali said, "Everybody in that stadium knows me, but none of them know you. Get out. I'm not coming with you. I'm not coming back to the Nation of Islam." And it was an interesting story because it, you know, doesn't really. I think it's just it was a very honest moment.
How long? Because earlier in his career, he was afraid that they would kill him.
Yeah.
If he left the nation.
That's right.
He
was afraid of Elijah Muhammad. Muhammad, you know, as long as he was alive, was ran that organization with a lot of power. And, you know, obviously people felt like Malcolm X and others who crossed Elijah Muhammad paid for it. And Ali mentioned a couple of times that he was afraid if he ever left that he might be assassinated.
Yeah. Now, I've talked about, I mean, you mentioned that towards more towards the end of your book, you talk about his transition with Wallace D. Muhammad. So that's a key point that he, I'm trying to figure out, because this was around what he was probably in his late 30s. That he finally accepted Islam. Real Islam, what we call it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Around what?
Yeah, it would have been the late 70s.
Late 70s?
Early 80s.
Do you
right.
think he was considering coming over to Islam from the nation at that point when he was scared that they were going to kill him?
No, I don't think so. I think it was Elijah Muhammad's sons that helped him, guided him toward real Islam.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've interviewed many. They have captains and former ministers from the nation, and we see a lot of this transition towards the end. Him and Malcolm also. Malcolm ended up leaving the nation, and because I make this differentiation, many people don't know that there's, you know, as Orthodox Muslims, we don't, you know, consider this is kind of. Not real Islam, you know what I mean? Because the teachings of real Islam, when, for instance, like what they originally believed in, white man's the devil,
right.
This, that, that has nothing to do. That's like, you know, worshiping a man, you know, real Islam calls about only worshiping the creator. So anyone who, many of these people who study the real Islam, they saw that, hold on, this has nothing, if you just open up the Quran, this has nothing to do with the real teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up making that transition. But it's interesting that I'm trying to figure out at what point, because he was scared, but Wallace D. ended up bringing a lot of people over. And then what happens from there, Farrakhan visits him to try to revive it, but then he said no.
Right. He was loyal to Wallace D. And
yeah.
One of the things that happened when Elijah died is Herbert told Ali that my father wanted you to listen to Wallace and to do whatever Wallace says.
Wait, Herbert is...
Herbert is Wallace's brother.
Oh, that's his brother.
Yeah.
Now. Okay.
They're both sons of Elijah.
Which one is older?
I think Herbert was the older.
Herbert was the older. Okay.
I think so. And it was Herbert who said, my father wishes for you to follow his successor, to follow Wallace D. and do whatever he is told, whatever he says. And Ali did that. And Wallace then began to transition toward Orthodox Islam, and Ali followed him.
Yeah.
But I don't think he would have done that prior to Elijah's death.
You talk about him also with his friends and colleagues, people who were Muslim, that how he was inviting them to pray.
I pray every morning at 5 o'clock. My clock rings at 4:30. I'm up at 5. I take a shower, and I put my white robe on. I put the towel on the floor, and I face the east towards Mecca. And we say, surely I have turned myself to thee, O Allah, trying to be upright, to him who has originated the heavens and the earth. And I am not of the polytheists. Surely my prayers, my sacrifices, my life, and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of all the worlds. No associates has he. This am I commanded. I am of those who submit. O Allah, thou art the king. Thou art my Lord, and I am thine servant. I have been greatly unjust to myself, and I do confess my fault. So please grant me protection against all my fault, for none grants protection against faults but thou. And lead me to the best of morals, for none can turn away from me the worst of morals but thee. And guide me to the best of morals, for none can guide to the best of morals but thee.
You discussed that in your book. Could you talk about that? And his real devotion and the solace that he found in prayer.
Another bath, another shower, clean my mouth, pray, and at 5 in the morning, this goes on when I'm right. Now, I didn't do that for the first Frazier fight, nor the first Norton fight.
Really?
No, sir. My head got big, and I started thinking it was my training camp and my boxing ability that kept me where I was at, and God punished me, and he gave me a good whooping. He broke my jaw in the second fight, and he got me whooped and knocked down in the Frazier fight, and I realized I wasn't that great after all. So I had to get not only together physically, but spiritually. For this fight, I've prayed every day for 5 days, five times a day for the past 4 months, and everything is perfect. And if Allah's with me, it ain't no way no man can win. No way.
And these things that really, this is also towards, at what point in his life was this?
I think it was after he retired from boxing. Yeah. He began to develop a real interest in studying the Quran and studying Islam and learning from other teachers. He would go to the homes of famous imams and would study with them and just sit at their table and listen. And he wasn't speaking as much because his voice was vanishing. So he really would just sit silently for hours and listen. And he would transcribe from the Quran and transcribe from speeches from others things that he'd read, books about Islam, and that's how he taught himself, by transcribing a lot of it, because he was not a great reader. But if he transcribed something into a notebook or onto a note card, his brain would absorb it. So he liked to do that. He also liked to copy down the contradictions in the Christian Bible and point out all of the things in there that couldn't be true because it said something opposite in one part of the Bible. So he loved gathering a bunch of Christians around.
And I always asked my mother, I said, "Mother, how come is everything white? I said, why is Jesus white with blonde hair and blue eyes? Why is the Lord's Supper all white men? Angels are white, Pope and Mary and even the angels." I said, "Mother, when we die, do we go to heaven?" She said, "Naturally, we go to heaven." I said, "Well, what happened to all the black angels when they took the pictures?"
So I choose to follow the Islamic path because I've never saw so much love. I never saw so many people hugging each other, kissing each other, praying five times a day, the women in the long garments, the way they would eat. You can go to any country and say, "Assalamu alaikum, wa alaikum assalam." You got a home, you got a brother. I chose the Islamic path because it connected me. As a Christian in America, I couldn't go to the white churches. As a Christian, that was for those people. It did them good. It didn't do me good.
And saying, "Look at all the mistakes that are in your Bible now," and then teaching them about the Quran. He really liked the idea of playing that role of teacher. And he would often, you know, there'd be these sports fans who just wanted to be around Ali, and he'd say, "Come back to my hotel room." And the next 3 hours, he'd be talking to them about the Bible versus the Quran, and you know, bore them to tears. But but he enjoyed that. I think it was important to him.
So the word Muslim means one who submits entirely to the will of God. Mm-hmm. One who submits entirely to the will of God. That's what Muslim means. So I don't know, I cannot be the judge on how much I submit entirely to the will of God. God himself can only judge us. So I can't say how good I am, and no true Muslim will brag or will even take a chance on saying he's good or he's halfway good or not. It's up to Allah, God, to be the judge, see?
You talk about him being also a peacemaker, going to other parts of the world, and calling for this unity, you know, this, because obviously there's, you know, great misunderstanding about Islam today. I mean, you can't doubt it. Many politicians have exploited that fact. But even at his time, it wasn't as obviously as bad, I don't think. But he was talking to Americans here about Islam, encourages them to look into it, and then he would go abroad and visit different countries and, you know, talk about, you mentioned this in your book.
Yeah, he would travel a lot throughout the Muslim world in particular, yeah, because he was the best-known Muslim in America, and he would say that the Muslims need to understand America, and Americans, yeah, need to understand the Muslims better, because this was before 9/11, but there were still these terrorist attacks. You know, there was an attack on the base in Lebanon, and there were all these. Even before 9/11, there was an image in some Americans' mind, a prejudice that Muslims were terrorists, and that was, you know, a generic label that was applied. And Ali really wanted to fight that. So he traveled around the world and in places that not a lot of Americans went. You know, he went to Pakistan and Afghanistan and gave these lectures about the importance of trying to build bridges between the two societies and the two religions.
Yeah. How did that shift happen at a time? How was he foreseen by the American public when he refused to go into the war? And how that all changed? I mean, he went from being someone, I mean, was he was like despised, wasn't he?
No. He was absolutely the most, I believe, the most hated man in America.
The
most hated man in America during the late 60s, yeah, when he refused to fight in Vietnam and announced his allegiance with the Nation of Islam, which the FBI considered a terrorist cult. And he was stripped of his boxing license. He couldn't work. He couldn't travel outside the country. And that only began to change over time, and a couple things happened. One is the Vietnam War became terribly unpopular, and people realized that he had a point in opposing it. And they also began to believe that he was at least legitimate in his religious beliefs, that he wasn't faking it.
Yeah.
You know, whether you liked the Nation of Islam or not, you had to admit the guy was loyal and truly believed, or else he wouldn't have given up 3.5 years of his career and millions of dollars to stand up for his religious beliefs. And then later, by the 90s, you know, he becomes a much more beloved figure, in part because he's been silenced by this disease, by Parkinson's. You know, he doesn't talk as much, so he just becomes kind of like a teddy bear. We all want to hug him and love him. And then he goes around giving these speeches about religious tolerance, and he becomes a much more you know, figure that we can all appreciate more.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that inspires me, and then there's... It shows that the earlier part of his life, and it's like anyone who's, it's hard to, fame opens up a whole another world of temptation and corruption and all these things that, you know, tantalize, are calling you, right? And you get susceptible to that. And some people can't overcome it. And some people, they drown themselves in all the things that come with it, right? And there's that part of his life. But then it just shows that, you know, a person who had, you know, no man's perfect, you know, you make mistakes. And in the earlier part of his life, you know, you can see where, and it goes with that story where he admits, you know, I've done some bad things. But then it shows, you know, that he really relied on the mercy of God, and he was really spending the latter part of his life. Because he didn't talk about that he truly started to become a man until his like late 30s, early,
right,
that he finally matured,
mm-hmm,
right? And then he started to really change his life and start to be a humanitarian and give back.
That's right. And he said often that, you know, this disease in many ways may have been a gift, because it forced him to slow down. It forced people to look at him differently and to say, you know, he was the greatest, the fastest, the strongest, the prettiest, and now look, he's trembling, he can't speak, but he was never ashamed of it. He stood up there in public and let people see him that way.
First of all, I want to thank Almighty God, Allah, for you all. Thank God for my talent, all the praise and honor that we give and goes to Allah.
Who are you most grateful to for your career?
My career, every day. Allah. All my success, all my protection, all my finishes, all my victory, all my courage, everything comes from Allah.
And he said, I want people to see me this way, because they'll know that we're all human. And it'll help other people to deal with their problems. So he was, in some ways, you know, he was the biggest egotist of all time. But in some ways, he was really humble and really believed that he was no different from anybody else.
So if after speaking to all these countless, you know, array of different people, people who were, you know, there from the beginning, how did that leave you off, you know, the feeling, you know, it's like you know him better now than you know,
I know him better than, you know, I know some of my own family. It's funny because there were times when and this happens with your own family too.
Yeah.
There were times where I was just so mad at him. How could you behave that way? How could you be so stupid? How could you say such a thing? But he always won me over again. He always came back and did something to charm me and to make me feel like he was a good person in the end. And it's complicated. Anytime you devote 4 years of your life or more to diving into another person's life, there's going to be some stuff that disturbs you. But overall, I felt like, that I love the guy.
So that took you said four years to
come? Yeah, a little more than 4 years.
Wow, that's a full-time job, you know, dedicated 4 years. People go to college 4 years.
That's right, yeah.
This is the Ali Institute.
I learned more in these 4 years.
Wow, you got a degree in Muhammad Ali.
That's right.
Yeah. So your book now is titled Ali. And this is going to be, where can people get the book?
It goes on sale October 3rd. It'll be on Amazon and all the bookstores, independent neighborhood bookstores should all have it. I hope people will check it out. And there's an audio book and an ebook too, so it should be easy to find.
You're going to have it on Audible?
Yes.
Yeah. Are you the one that's...
No, they got a real actor to do it, somebody better than me.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, I appreciate you spending the time with us here on The Dean Show. And sharing some of these insights from his life. Hopefully, there was a lot to cover. Hopefully, God willing, we can have you back.
That'd
you know,
be great.
Because there's a lot more to talk about, you know.
Anytime.
It's a big book, but we had a short amount of time. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you guys for tuning in. Jonathan with his new book, Ali. And make sure you check it out. And we'll see you next time here on The Dean Show. Until then, peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.
What's the best thing I can do? Get ready to meet God. Owning real estate, going in business, teaching boxers, that won't get me to heaven. God is watching me. God don't praise me because I beat Joe Frazier. God don't care nothing about England or America as far as your wealth is all his. He wants to know how do we treat each other, how do we help each other. So, I'm going to dedicate my life to using my name and popularity, helping charities, helping people, uniting people, bringing people bumming each other because of religious beliefs. We need somebody in the world to help us make peace. So when I die, if there's a heaven, I want to see it. Because we live how long? 80 years? The odds are everybody in this room, some of you going to be dead 20 years from now. Some of you going to be dead 50 years from now. Some are going to be dead 30. Some are going to be dead 60, 70 years from now. We all going to die soon. So this is a test to see where will we spend our life in heaven or hell. This is not the life now. Your real self is inside you. Your body gets old. Some of you go to look at the fridge, you don't have no teeth, your hair is leaving you, your bodies get tired, but your soul and your spirit never die. That's going to live forever. So your body is just housing your soul and spirit. So God is testing us on how we treat each other, how we live, to see where our real home be in heaven. So this physical stuff don't last for so long. So my car, this building is going to be here when the man who built it dead. There have been many kings and queens of England. They're all dead. After this one is gone, another one will come. So we don't stay here. We're just trustees. We don't own nothing. Even your children are not yours, if you think I'm lying. Your wife is not yours. You don't own your children. You don't own your family. So what am I saying? The most important thing about life is what's going to happen when you die. Are you going to go to heaven or hell? And that's eternity. How long is eternity? So what am I going to do when I'm through fighting? I only have 16 years to be productive. Get myself ready to meet God and go to the best place. Don't that make sense? Thank you.